I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect Symphony of the Sword, The Rose That Blooms in the City of Light by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Ann Cross and John Trussell. Juri Arisukawa's first view of Paris was not an inspiring one. The afternoon of Sunday, March 13th, 2405, was a rather rainy and gray one, shrouding the City of Light in fog and generally preventing it from living up to its nickname. To make matters worse, the Airbus A7690 suborbital shuttlecraft carrying her from Boston Logan to Paris de Gaulle had taken a remarkably uninteresting glide slope for its approach, no doubt also because of the foul weather. The flight itself was quite a thing to consider for one as unused to the local technology as Juri. Back in her homeworld, she had once flown from her native land to the distant country of Golia for an international fencing conference, similar in concept to the musical symposium Caitlin was attending in Paris. But that flight had been aboard a wide-body jet, which, for all its first-class creature comforts, had still taken nearly 15 hours to complete the journey. Nihonia's location at the center of the world occasionally made it an inconvenient place to hail from. This trip, by contrast, had taken barely an hour from the time the Airbus's wheels left the runway in Boston to touchdown on the outskirts of Paris. In the process, the sky outside the window had gone from blue to black to gray as the aircraft leaped up, almost into space, and then arced back down again to Earth, having covered an ocean in a single ion-driven leap. Remarkable to think about, if not all that exciting in the actual experience. At any rate, here she was on the curb in front of Terminal B, watching a uniformed cab driver load her bags and Caitlin's into the trunk of a curiously shaped black automobile. She listened as Kate explained their destination to the driver. Saint-Neuf, rue Saint-Louis-en-L'Île, si vous plaît. And noted the ready nod and slightly indulgent smile on the man's face as he held the cab's rear door for the two women to embark. Juri guessed he was touched that a girl who stuttered as badly as Kate did would take it upon herself to do so in a foreign language just to address a cabbie in his own tongue. She was a little impressed by it herself, come to that. "Isn't it an interesting coincidence?" Juri mused as the car started off toward the access highway to Paris, "that the language they speak here is all but identical to Gaulish." Kate nodded. "Parallel dimensions," she said, shrugging. "It happens. Juri sighed inwardly. Kate was nice, kind-hearted, and brave. She'd heard stories of the brown-haired girl's courage and sweetness from people whose words Juri trusted, but that stutter made it difficult to connect with her. Miki Kaworu had told her that it would fade with time and strengthened acquaintance, but so far it hadn't abated very much at all. Juri supposed she wasn't making it any easier, but then she never had been very good at making friends. She noticed Kate looking at her with a small, private smile, as though she knew what Juri had been thinking and understood. It was a disconcerting habit, thought Juri. She smiled, a bit thinly, and turned her head to look out the window as the cab made its way into Paris in the rain. The Hôtel des Deux Îles, where IRCAM, the sponsoring body of the symposium Kate was attending, had lodged their guest from WPI and her companion, was located almost smack in the center of the Île Saint-Louis, the smaller of the two islands in the Seine at the center of Paris. Constructed in 2380 on the site of the third hotel to bear the name, it was still fairly new, yet, despite being a 30-story tower hotel, it managed to maintain a curious, undefinable atmosphere that made it somehow fit in on the little island, still packed with quaint homes and other old buildings. Perhaps it was the architecture, or the interior decoration, both of which somehow managed to make the place look like it was the sort of 30-story tower hotel Baron Haussmann would have raised, had he possessed the technology to build 30-story tower hotels. Whichever, Caitlin appreciated it. She'd stayed here the previous year, attending her first international music conference, and become very fond of the hotel's combination of modern convenience and old-world charm. The room to which she and Jury were shown was almost too small for the bureau, small table, and pair of queen beds it contained, but that fact, combined with its entirely un-hotel room-like decor, dark wood trim, cream-colored plastered walls, mismatched quilts, beautifully carved dark wood furniture, made it feel more like a spare bedroom in somebody's house than a planned-by-design hotel accommodation. Kate tipped the bellboy and thanked him for his help, shut the door, and then went to the window and pulled open the curtains. "Ah," she said, smiling. "Perfect." Jury went to stand by her, wondering what was so perfect about a gray, rainy, early afternoon, even in a city as vaunted as Paris. Then she looked out of the window and had her answer. The room was on the 23rd floor, high enough that it overlooked every other building on that end of the Ile Saint-Louis, but not so high that it made one feel detached from the view below. Not only the western half of the island could be seen from here, but also the neighboring Ile de la Cité, the heart of Paris itself. And the nearest thing to them on that island, perched on the eastern tip, was the great Cathedral of Notre Dame. Jury Arisugawa was hardly a Christian. The religion was unknown in Sefiro, whose inhabitants tended toward a distracted sort of deism, a monotheistic belief in a god the watchmaker sort who had no further interest in the world now that he had set it running. Still, she was an aesthete, and as such, she admired Notre Dame for its handsomeness and the artistry of its construction, whatever its purpose. She'd seen pictures of it in the Paris guidebook she'd bought on agreeing to come here, but they didn't compare to seeing it in person, even at a distance through the fog. She smiled and went to start unpacking her things. Silently, Caitlin stood and admired the view of Notre Dame for a few more moments, then went to do the same. They had just sat down to dinner at a brasserie in the Place Dauphine, when Jury said, "Caitlin, I've been thinking." "Hmm?" said Kate, raising her eyes from the menu. "While we're here," said Jury, "perhaps we ought to speak French with each other for practice." She smiled and went on, "I haven't used my Gaulish regularly since I was with Charbonneau, and that was years ago." Kate looked a bit dubious. "Well," she replied in French, it'll probably make me even harder to understand. Jury nodded. "That's all right. You'll get used to me sooner or later. In the meantime, don't worry about it. If I can't figure something out, I'll get you to repeat it and listen harder." Kate thought on that for a moment, then shrugged. If you say so, she replied. The conversation faltered there as both women busied themselves with their menus. Jury frowned behind her menu where she thought no one could see her, and wondered what she was doing here. Behind the counter, the brasserie's owner saw her scowl and thought to himself, Ah, what have we here? He'd noticed them when they came in, two young women he'd never seen before. The Brasserie Dauphine didn't get much in the way of unfamiliar customers. It was frequented by the employees of the Préfecture de Police and the Palais de Justice, a crowd that didn't change much. And so Marcel Janvier noticed new faces readily. He'd have noticed these two in any case. The one wasn't perhaps so remarkable, a shortish, slim girl of perhaps 16, with long brown hair that had a very slight curl to it, glasses, and a pretty smile, in jeans, a gray sweatshirt with the name and seal of an American school, practical walking shoes, and a brown leather jacket like aviators used to wear. She carried a black wooden walking stick, though she didn't seem to have a limp. A curious affectation, Janvier thought, but the children these days, what can one do? The brown-haired girl was overshadowed by her slightly older companion, a tall, slender, but well-appointed redhead with her hair done up in vertical curls, a cool, aristocratic face, and devil-green eyes. This one wore very stylish clothes, from her low-heeled shoes to her neat black pants, to her crisp white blouse and tidy charcoal jacket, to the gray cashmere overcoat she'd carefully hung on the back of their table's unoccupied third chair. The redhead was a frowner. In a rather comical way, she reminded Janvier of his most common customers, the policemen of the Quai des Orfèvres. So serious. That was no way for a visitor to Paris to be, even with the political skies becoming steadily gloomier and the weather so gray and dreary. And the other one, though she had smiled when they entered, seemed worried about something now, which was no better for Janvier's sensibilities than her companion's frown. Now that he came to look at her more closely, the brown-haired girl looked familiar. Janvier rarely forgot a customer, and now he ran his mind back, thinking, and soon he had her. She'd been here a year before, a year younger, of course, a year smaller, and alone. He remembered the black stick and the pretty smile. She was an American student, as her shirt indicated. She had an English name. Carolyn, maybe? No. Caitlin. He tried to remember, and it came to him. She'd been a guest at the annual Urquhem Symposium. He supposed she must be back for this year's, and this time she had brought a guest? Or was the redhead a fellow musician, brought together with her by the conference, and invited along to the Brasserie Dauphine for a dinner of peers? No, Janvier thought not. They weren't talking over sheet music, and if there was one thing he knew about comrades in any field of intellectual endeavor, it was that they invariably talked shop over dinner at the Brasserie Dauphine. He considered what to do about the mood for a moment, then smiled, selected a bottle of wine, and bustled over to the table with it and a pair of glasses. "Good evening, ladies," he said with a smile. He placed the glasses on the table, then presented the bottle with a flourish and added, "Welcome to Paris." Caitlin looked up at him with a faintly startled smile. "Oh," she said, "hello, Monsieur Janvier. Do you remember me?" Janvier smiled widely. "But of course I remember you, my dear. You're the young lady who tuned my piano last year, and it has never sounded better, although since you went back to the States there's been no one to play it." He gestured to the three trench-coated people, two men and a woman, in the corner booth who were the place's only other occupants at the moment, and grinned. "My usual crowd isn't very musical." "Talking about us behind our backs again, Janvier?" one of the men in the booth called, a grin on his weather-beaten face. "Of course, Superintendent," Janvier replied. "The common people always talk about the cops behind their backs." "Isn't that the truth?" said the superintendent. He raised his glass and turned back to his colleagues. "I regret, however," said Janvier, "that I have not met your charming companion before." He turned to the redhead, bowing, and said, "I am Marcel Janvier, miss. Welcome to my little place." "My name is Jury," said she, nodding graciously. "I am pleased to meet you, Monsieur Janvier." "Ah, no, my dear, the pleasure is mine. Now then, what would you young ladies like to eat tonight? I have a good fillet of sole." "How is the contrefilet?" Jury inquired. Janvier flip-flopped a hand. "Not so bad," he said with an apologetic look. "I'm not equipped like a steakhouse, but Mama does her best." "I'll try it anyway," said Jury with a mild smile. "Very good, very good. And for you, miss?" he asked, turning to Kate.
I'll have the sole," said Kate.
"Most excellent," said Janvier. "Shall I pour your wine before I go and give your order to Mama?"
Jury said she would like that, thank you. But Caitlin went a little pink and replied, No, thank you. I'm not old enough. Maybe Thursday?
Jury raised an eyebrow. Thursday is your birthday?
Kate nodded. That's why...
She paused, as if considering the pain of thrashing her way through a full explanation, then waved a hand in a fill-it-in sort of way and said,
The car.
Ah, said Jury, nodding.
I think, said Janvier with a smile, we might stretch a point for the sake of hospitality.
Kate cast an unconvinced glance at the policeman in the corner booth.
But you're regulars?
Janvier fanned a hand at them.
Bah! My boys are from the K. They're interested in murder and burglary and arson, not fiddling social regulations. Isn't that right, Superintendent Marquette?
Of course, Janvier, said the man in the brown trench coat, who hadn't heard what he was being asked.
Anything you say. Might I trouble you for another Pernod?
In a moment, Superintendent, in a moment.
The burly publican smiled at the two girls, poured their wine, and went off to take their orders to the kitchen and get the policeman his Pernod. Kate gazed thoughtfully at her wine for a moment, then raised it to Jury and drank. Jury glanced at her Institute Duelist Society ring, considering the last time she'd drunk wine. Then she returned the salute and tried it herself. It was good wine, young and a bit sharp, but good all the same. Even with the gray, chilly raininess of the day, the friendliness of the owner and the warm, cheerful charm of this little restaurant lifted Jury's mood. Maybe, she thought, this would work out after all. She and Caitlin didn't say much to each other for the rest of the meal, but the silence between them was at least no longer awkward. Jury considered the loin steak quite a bit better than not so bad, and the potatoes were perfect, crisp and hot, while Kate pronounced the fillet of sole and salad exquisite. Presently they finished, paid, and thanked the owner, then went back out into the rain. Evening had fallen while they were eating, and the lights along the Place Dauphine were each its own separate globe of yellow-white light, glowing at the tops of the black metal lampposts like street lamps in an oil painting. They walked down the Quai des Orfèvres, turned left to walk past the ornate gates of the Palais de Justice, then around the side of the Préfecture de Police to the Rue de la Cité. With the rain hissing softly around them, pattering on their umbrellas, and the fog enfolding everything with a soft glow from the street lamps, it was as though they were the only two people in Paris, possibly the only two in the world. Lights burned in the windows of the prefecture, but no cars plied the streets and no one else walked the pavements. Jury found it quite restful. From there it wasn't far to Notre Dame, hulking silent and dark against the night glow of Paris, against the overcast. In the hush, Kate and Jury walked through the shadowed gardens alongside the great cathedral, met up with the Quai aux Fleurs at the island's eastern tip, and crossed the little bridge to the Île Saint-Louis again. As they walked up the Rue Saint-Louis-en-l'Île toward the hotel, Caitlin took off her eyeglasses, folded them up, and tucked them into the inside pocket of her bomber jacket. Then she folded up her umbrella suddenly, stopped walking, and upturned her face to the rainy sky, letting the falling water dampen her hair and trickle down across her features. Jury stopped and observed her, slightly bemused, as she stood with her arms extended, palms upward, and smiled up into the rain. After a few seconds of that, Kate opened her eyes and smiled at Jury's puzzled look.
"Glad to be in Paris," she said. I love this city, even in the rain.
More than Toronto? Jury wondered.
Differently,
Kate replied. Toronto is a friend. Paris is an old uncle who doesn't visit often.
Jury smiled. I understand, she said. I'd rather not get my coat wet, though, so I don't think I'll be joining you.
Kate grinned and skipped off away down the street, hopping over puddles like a little girl on an outing with her parents, twirling with her arms outstretched and her face raised to catch the rain once more. The next day was day one of the International Conference of Modern Composers. Caitlin rose early, dressed in the more somber of the two skirt suits she'd brought with her, crossed the Pont Marie, and walked northwest across the 4th arrondissement to the Centre Georges Pompidou.
"That's where your conference is being held?" Jury had inquired, looking at the photograph in the guidebook.
"Next door," Kate told her.
"Interesting building," said Jury. "When is it expected to be finished?"
"1977.
Oh."
Jury woke to find her already gone, and spent a few minutes perusing her guidebook, deciding where to go today. She and Kate had discussed their plans for the week a bit the night before, between returning from their rainy walk and going to bed, so she knew a few things Kate would rather she not do during the days, so that they could do them together in the evenings. Aside from that, her schedule was open until 6:30 or so, when Kate would get back from the Centre Pompidou, and they could go in search of dinner. She considered it for a few minutes, then went and prepared herself for the day. After completing her morning toilet, she dressed. As she was buttoning her shirt, she opened the drapes and looked out the window. The overcast and its attendant rain were gone, and in their place a dazzling clear blue sky arched over Paris, making it glitter and shine. Notre Dame no longer hunkered in the mist and looked vaguely foreboding. Now it reached for the heavens it was built to glorify, somehow defying the taller buildings that surrounded it, and still appearing the loftiest structure in the heart of the city. Jury smiled, shrugged into her overcoat, and tucked the guidebook into her inside pocket. Today she would play it by ear. The first 3 days of the week went past in a tranquil sort of way, with beautiful, crisp, clear, cool weather that was almost more like autumn than spring. During the days, Caitlin attended the conference, working with fellow musicians from all over the galaxy, hearing lectures on musical theory, implementation, and interpretation, and preparing for the exhibition concert which comprised the symposium's closing ceremonies on Friday night. While she was busy with that, Jury rambled around Paris, visiting museums, seeing the city's multifarious monuments, and shopping. In the evenings, they decided, they'd visit a different district each night, sampling the different parts of the city like a buffet. On Monday, after visiting their neighbor cathedral, just as impressive and lovely inside as out, they crossed the Pont de la Tournelle to the left bank in the 5th arrondissement, and spent an evening strolling through the university sector, the Quartier Latin. The next night, they took the metro a little further south, to the 14th arrondissement. There they walked the streets of Montparnasse, the famed literary district, home of many of the world's famous writers in the early 20th, mid-21st, and late 23rd centuries. As they walked the pavements of Paris, bought crepes from sidewalk vendors, and drank in the sights, sounds, and smells of a city many Earth people considered the most vibrant on the planet, perhaps in the civilized galaxy, Caitlin and Jury slowly grew more comfortable in each other's presence, without even quite realizing that they were. They still didn't say all that much. Nudges, points, smiles, and nods covered much of the sightseeing vocabulary, and much of the time each seemed lost in her own thoughts. But they communicated more, all the same. By the time they returned to the Hôtel des Deux Îles, on Tuesday night, they had nearly shed the silent awkwardness of strangers for the quiet comfort of acquaintances on their way to becoming friends. On Wednesday, they went west instead of south, riding the metro out to the Étoile Charles de Gaulle, and then walking all the way back along the Champs-Élysées. Along the way, something remarkable happened, though it happened so slowly that Jury almost didn't realize it at first. Caitlin became voluble. She started by asking, as they descended to the metro at Saint-Michel, how Jury had spent her day, then listened with her usual bright-eyed, quiet, nodding attentiveness, as Jury described her day among the quiet tombs and sunlit trees of the Cimetière du Père Lachaise. Caitlin teased Jury gently about the morbidity of spending a day alone in a cemetery, of all things, and listened with smiling good humor as Jury defended her choice in terms of architectural interest and a desire for someplace quiet to reflect on certain matters. Then she remarked that Jury had certainly had a nicer day than she had, and as they emerged from the underground in the shadow of the Arc de Triomphe, the story of her day started emerging, slowly and haltingly, but doggedly at first, then with an increasing pace and smoothness as she warmed to the dialogue. So it was that, as they waited across the intersection with the Avenue Georges V, Jury suddenly realized that Caitlin was talking to her, and had been in a steady stream since they left the metro. That's not to say Jury hadn't been listening, because she had, but it hadn't really dawned on her what it meant that she had such a remarkable flow of language to listen to until that moment. Caitlin spoke eloquently, her French fluent and fluid. She still stuttered, of course, but she'd stopped stumbling over whole words and leaving out the unnecessary ones, and stopped looking embarrassed as she essayed the larger, more complicated ones. She gestured here and there in an amusingly Gallic fashion as she spoke, too. What had struck Jury suddenly was that, though Kate's stutter had not gone, she wasn't having to pay uncomfortably close attention just to understand what the other girl was saying anymore. The substance of Caitlin's dissertation seemed to be that, although she was enjoying the conference's musical aspects immensely, she was finding some of its social aspects very tiresome indeed. Musicians, she explained, tended to be a somewhat quarrelsome lot when gathered together in groups, and additionally, though some were committed to the beauty and universality of music as a means to emotional and conceptual, as opposed to literal, you understand, although it can be that too, communication, others were, well, just plain snobbed. Fortunately, praise Corwin's holy aunt Belle, blessed be her celestial kitchen, Elizabeth Broadbank had neither interest nor talent in musical circles, so Kate didn't have her to deal with. But to hear her gripe about him, the unnamed individual known to Jury only as that pompous cretin from the École Musico-Technologique in Nice, repeated consonants where appropriate, was almost as irritating. His opinion of Caitlin's first product she dared call a symphony, the one she had worked with Miki on over Christmas, was a dismissive, crude, of course, and mired in archaism, but then that sort of antique music is popular in the provinces, isn't it, dear? Jury raised an eyebrow. He actually called New Avalon the provinces? She inquired. Yep, said Kate. Another time he said that he supposed I work with symphonic orchestras because modern instruments aren't available on the outer rim. He sounds like quite a charmer, Jury mused dryly. Did you inform him that you also lead a successful electric band? Oh, rock is way out at the École Musico-Technologique, Kate assured her, nodding in an exaggerated yes-man style. Even further than symphonic. What do they prefer at the École Musico-Technologique? Jury wondered. They call it l'expérience sonique, said Kate grandly. Personally, she added darkly, I think it sounds like random RF noise. Set to an electro drum, slave to a partially crashed neural net. She splayed a hand on her chest and went on in a dramatically haughty sort of way. But this sad unenlightenment of mine is a natural product of my wilderness upbringing. One mustn't hold it against me. Jury actually giggled at that, which made Kate glance at her in mild surprise, then cock her eyebrows conspiratorially at the eye contact, and snicker in return. "Well," said Jury when they were finished laughing, "you'll have your chance for vindication on Friday evening." "If one of my pieces is selected," Kate said. "Ragoulin is on the selection committee. But so is Monsieur Chalfon, and he really liked them. The symphony's too involved to put on with such short notice. But maybe the piano sonata." Well, thought Jury, at least the pompous cretin has a name now, or part of one, anyway. It was about 2 miles down the Champs-Élysées from the Étoile to the Place de la Concorde. With evening traffic, other pedestrians, and their own leisurely pace, it took Caitlin and Jury an hour or so to reach the Obelisque, standing in the center of the Place. The evening was cool but comfortable, the night sky over Paris clear and starry, as they stood looking up at the massive stone needle, an ancient Egyptian relic given as a gift to France in the 19th century. Caitlin opined that WPI ought to put one like it in the center of the quadrangle instead of that silly flat dedication stone. They walked through the breeze-ruffled leafiness of the Jardin des Tuileries, while Kate tried to explain just what it was they did at the International Conference of Modern Composers. Jury, not being a musician, didn't really follow most of the technical bits, but she didn't really care. The important thing was that Kate was speaking comfortably, no longer self-conscious about her speech impediment in front of Jury. The redhead found that gratifying, for though she knew most people found her intimidating and often used that fact to her advantage, she sometimes wished she could turn it off. Perhaps that was one of the reasons she'd come to like Utina Tenjo, the fact that Utina had never seemed particularly awed by her. Impressed, yes, but not to the point where her own capacities were diminished by it. It was a refreshing change from cowing people with a glance. She pulled her train of thought back from that irrelevant digression and listened as Kate described a bit more of the Byzantine internal politics of the colloquy. It all sounded quite maddening, but she noticed Kate was becoming more cheerful as she complained about it at greater length. A little smile quirked Jury's lips as she recognized the beneficial effects of venting. It was another thing she had never been particularly good at, but perhaps if she watched long enough she could pick up a thing or two. The Jardins des Tuileries eventually led to the Place du Carrousel, beyond which lay the gleaming 20th-century glass pyramid that was the entrance to the Louvre. This, Kate explained unnecessarily, since Jury had a guidebook, was one of the galaxy's most famous museums of fine art, a panoply of the finest paintings and sculptures human history had to offer, if you were into that sort of thing. Kate went on to explain that she wasn't into that sort of thing, so if Jury wanted to see it, she ought to come back during the day, tomorrow or Friday. A full day ought to be devoted to it anyway, and Kate hadn't the time. By now it was nearly 9 in the evening, as they walked along the Quai du Louvre, and they were hungry. They found a café at random and were pleasantly surprised by the food, though the service was a bit surly. That couldn't dent Caitlin's mood, though. She seemed happier than she'd been since Jury had met her. As far as Jury could tell, Kate was always somewhat upbeat, except when she was angry about some emergency, like Liza Broadbank's treatment of Miki Kaworu back in C-term. Normally, though, it was a quiet sort of upbeatness. Kate tended to be the quietly smiling one in the corner with a book, a rainy-day contentment kind of girl, not an animated discusser of things. Tonight, though, she was certainly that. She wanted to talk about anything and everything. Over soup, she asked Jury how she was finding the adjustment to the new world she found herself in. "Everybody else has had at least one rough patch," she explained, "and I wanted you to know." Caitlin paused, going a little pink in the cheeks, and then went on, "If you need someone to talk to about it, I'm a good listener. Ask Utena, she added with a slightly sheepish smile.
It's good of you, said Juri, but I'm fine, thank you. It's really not much more of an adjustment than when I left home for the academy in the first place.
As if to prevent any inquiry on that subject, she went on, I'm more concerned at this point for Miki.
Kate nodded. He had a very tough time, she allowed, what with Liza targeting him and all. But I think he's doing all right now.
She grinned a little slyly and added, of course, for the full story on that, you'd have to talk to Azalin.
Juri frowned thoughtfully. She said, and finished her soup. That's what I'm concerned about. I doubt he really understands what he's letting himself in for, getting involved with a person like her.
Kate arched an eyebrow. What's that supposed to mean? She inquired, her tone milder than perhaps it ought to have been.
Only this. People like her aren't known where we come from. Or rather, they're known in rather uncomplimentary terms. I understand, Juri added, raising an open palm to forestall comment, that she is different, that things are different here. But I'm not certain that Miki is mature enough to understand such a thing. He's not very well versed in the ways of the world. And he's so young, the same age as your brother, who doesn't know what he's involving himself in either.
Corwin, said Kate with neither rancor nor warmth, is not a permissible topic for discussion in this context.
I apologize, said Juri with her palm raised again. It was a lapse, although I feel obliged to mention that I am primarily concerned for him. I hate to see yet another innocent soul blunder into all that mess. But he seems bound to do so, and the rest of you seem bound to let him, so I'll let it drop for peace's sake.
Caitlin nodded. I appreciate that, she said dryly.
Miki, though, I think I have some right to be worried about, Juri went on. His intellect exceeds his years, but I'm afraid his wisdom may be a different story. Of all of us who came from Sephiro, I think I know him best. Since he first came to the Academy, I was essentially his only friend, until Tenjo and Himemiya. His reserve, his shyness, hide a foolishly, childishly passionate heart. You're a musician, like him. You should recognize that.
Passionate, yes, Kate replied. Foolish and childish, I dispute.
If she knew or felt that Juri had just called her foolish and childish by association, she let it pass lightly. In this vein, they sat across the table on the sidewalk by the Rue de Rivoli for almost 2 hours and argued. They didn't fight, they argued, after the ancient Greek fashion, taking opposing viewpoints and defending them with wit and courtesy. Juri's view was that Miki, being young, naive, and foolishly passionate, was setting himself up for heartbreak by his involvement with Azalin Devere Natoshkin. That though he might intellectually understand the alien nature of her affection toward him, he wouldn't be able to grasp or return it emotionally, and thus he would inevitably fall for her in the conventional human way, if he hadn't already, and be devastated when she failed to return that sentiment. Caitlin's view was that Juri wasn't giving Miki enough credit, that Miki already understood the Dentrovian way quite well, and that he was now, in effect, exploring it himself. That he and Azalin were, in effect, a Dentrovian spirit pair now, for however long such transitory things lasted, and that when they parted it would be in the Dentrovian way, without the bleeding wounds of a failed human love. Juri requested clarification at this point. Did that mean Caitlin didn't think Miki capable of love in the human fashion, as it were? Was Kate saying that Miki was trapped forever in a cycle of odd holidays and one-night stands?
No, Kate wasn't saying that at all. Kate was saying that in his interaction with Azalin, Minky was thinking and feeling like a Dentrovian, but that did not necessarily mean he would handle all of his life's interactions that way. That would be like saying that, because Caitlin disliked Liza Broadbank, she was thus doomed to dislike all tall, elegant women of roughly her own age, and that was clearly ludicrous, was it not? No, what Kate was saying was that everyone's interactions are different with every individual one knows, and that each one of those interactions was always changing and evolving, as the people at either end of it changed and evolved. With Azalin, Miki could match her way of feeling as he learned it from her, but that was no indication that he wouldn't possibly fall head over heels in the human fashion for somebody someday, possibly even somebody he already knew, as his life and those of his friends grew around him. All right, fine, for sake of argument, said Jury. But suppose that happened, what would Azalin do about it? Rejoice, of course, was the answer. Azalin always rejoices in love between people. Look, you're making this much more complicated than it has to be. You worry too much about hypothetical things. If you want to be happy, you're going to have to let go of your need to control everything that happens to you and just let things unfold as they will. React. Don't try to act all the time. Jury conceded that she supposed Kate might have something there, and they wrapped up their argument, drank their tea, paid their bill, walked back to the Ile Saint-Louis, and went to bed, both pleased and thoughtful about the evening's conversation.